Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Panel number two of environmental conflicts along the path for sustainable development. And this panel's topic is perspectives on the development of public lands and natural resources. Public lands, some people don't realize, federal public lands, constitute roughly one-third of the American land mass. It evokes public lands, songs by Woody Guthrie. I will not sing "This Land is My Land, This Land is Our Land." Teddy Roosevelt made his mark with public lands. In fact, in many ways, his legacy as a president is in large part based upon public lands. Even more recently, presidents such as Bill Clinton and George Bush, very different in a lot of different ways, each made a move to deal with public lands and to have their legacy in some manner or another attached to public lands. And public lands, in addition to their size, their relative size, represent a lot of our dreams and our passions and even our business. A lot of our fossil fuel extraction has occurred on public lands. Alternative energy that we heard in the previous panel, a lot of that is occurring on public lands, solar and wind. Even uranium mining near the Grand Canyon. If you think uranium is renewable alternative, I don't think that it is myself, but that is occurring on public lands. The Keystone pipeline debate that Kate from the Sierra Club talked about for a brief minute, transecting public lands. Many of our endangered species, many hunting opportunities, many of the forms of recreation that we enjoy, hiking, birding, camping, off-road vehicle use for those who like that type of thing, all occur on federal public lands, our lands, lands that we all share as Americans. And the legal fabric for public lands is as diverse as the interests on the lands themselves. Not only does the Constitution give Congress basically full power to legislate for federal public lands, the statutory landscape is incredibly diverse, with organic statutes dealing with the National Park Service, the National Forest Service, BLM, the National Wildlife Refuge System, Department of Defense, Marine Sanctuaries, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Outer Continental Shelf and our EEZ, Bureau of Reclamation Lands, monuments created by the Antiquities Act, wilderness designations, and state and local lands as well, all a part of the fabric of public lands. And what's going to happen over the course of the next hour or so is that we have four incredibly experienced and people who I've known for a long time who've worked on public lands going to give us their perspective. Obviously, this is not going to be a detailed examination of public land, but a storytelling where we're going to try to draw out some themes about what's happening on public lands today and why conflicts are or are not occurring. And one of the things that I want you to think about when you hear all four of these perspectives, and they're going to be very different, or at least they're going to be somewhat different, is whether natural resource conflict is always a bad thing. Sometimes conflicts, if set upright, can actually be a constructive thing. Sometimes it can be destructive. It really does depend. And so as you hear these stories over the course of the next hour, think about whether you're hearing about a conflict and think about whether you're hearing about a conflict that's constructive or destructive. That's my little professorial hortatory advice for all of you. So here's the order. I'm not going to read the bios because they're in the materials you already received, and they would take too long because these four gentlemen are very distinguished. We're going to have Ed from BLM go first, talking about the federal government's perspective. Larry from Holland & Knight is going to go second. Paul from Perkins Coie is going to go third. Tyler from Public Citizen is going to back cleanup. And then hopefully we will have plenty of time for question and answer. And with no further ado, Mr. Roberson.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Everybody hear me? I want to thank American University for hosting this discussion today about the challenges and the opportunities that we have before us as we endeavor to achieve sustainability in the use of America's natural resources and public lands. appreciate the preceding panel's discussion for those of you all that were in here. And it presented both the promise and the problems of alternative energy development challenges. My vita does indicate that I'm Ed Robertson, the Assistant Director of BLM for Renewable Resources and Planning. And I'm often confused with the renewable energy czar of the BLM, who is Ray Brady. Renewable energy in BLM is all about natural and cultural resources, but we are overseeing the renewable energy program through those natural, cultural, planning, and environmental programs that I manage or oversee. I came to the Bureau after being with a master's degree in land use planning and after being a regional planner in Florida. And I've been with the Bureau for 32 years. And I entitled my remarks today, Sustainability, BLM's 21st Century Approach to Conservation and Development. I want to start with a brief summary of the history and mission of BLM. How many of you are familiar with the Bureau of Land Management? Bill certainly is, and you may have learned in your class. I think Paul knows something about it, too, because we work together. So I will be brief. I know that we have a short time, but once I talk about a little bit of the history and mission of BLM, I'll discuss the challenges of sustainability, describe BLM's landscape approach to conservation and development, and then conclude by highlighting some of the steps we're taking as we strive for sustainability in our public lands and associated natural resources. To preface my remark, I had a chat with Bob Abbey, our director, before I came over here, and I wanted to know if he had a message for me to deliver, and he said, you know, I want you to tell them that the decisions we make about public lands management today are not only for those who live today, but for those yet to be born. A simple definition of sustainable would be something that works for both present and future generations. That is what Congress envisioned when it passed the Organic Act for the BLM, which is called Federal Land Policy and Management Act. I'm not sure, again, how many of you are familiar, although I see saw the hands. We started as the General Land Office 200 years ago in 2012, or in 1812. We're celebrating at the Center for the American West in Boulder this fall, the 200th anniversary of the General Land Office. It was established as with a mission which was pretty awesome at that time when you looked at the American West and Midwest from the developed East Coast, to superintend, execute, and perform all such acts and things touching and respecting the public lands of the United States. Pretty awesome. They oversaw such things as land sales, disposition of military veteran lands, homesteading, administration of railroad grants, and many other land policies that were really out there to encourage the development and settlement of the West. As our public lands were being settled and developed, there were also in the early 1800s, there were also things going on related to prospecting and mining. Those things were taking place without authorization or regulation, and in the 1860s, Congress decided to take some action to rectify the situation. They introduced the first mining laws and started to discuss mining laws in 1860, and that was 50 years after BLM started, our General Land Office started. So the General Mining Law of 1872 is one I'm sure you all are studying. It's one still 136 years later, still in effect. And Congress essentially gave the development of certain lands, certain minerals on public lands, priority over other land uses. In the early 1900s, the General Land Office began to reserve minerals in the patents that were issued for land ownership for such things as coal, oil, and gas. And then they began to pass mineral leasing acts with policies that brought the U.S. Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines into the management of America's energy and mineral resources. Similar to the unregulated prospecting that was taking place in the land, we also had, in the 1800s, unregulated grazing. And similar to the negative effects that occurred with unregulated prospecting, unregulated grazing brought about overgrazing and serious degradation of public rangeland. So the Congress passed the Taylor Grazing Act in 1934, and its stated purpose was to stop injury to public grazing lands by preventing overgrazing and soil deterioration. Interior Secretary at that time, Harold Ickes, formed the Division of Grazing, and they began to implement the act, began to develop rules and regulations, and with the intent to conserve and restore rangelands. The Grazing Service was renamed in 41 and became the Grazing Service. Division of Grazing became the Grazing Service in 1947. After a year of study, the BLM was formed out of the remnant parts of the General Land Office and the Grazing Service. We continued to dispose of public lands and minerals over the years, but we took on increasing management role for those resources that were on the land. And we began to expand our responsibilities. In 1976, Congress passed, as I mentioned a minute ago, the Federal Land Policy Management Act. And in that, Congress declared that it's the policy of the United States that public lands would be retained in federal ownership and managed on a basis of multiple use and sustained yield. Those are critical points, and I'll go into them when I talk about our mission. FLIPMA had more provisions and has been amended from time to time in the last 36 years, but I won't go into that. I'm going to focus in on our mission. I would like to refer you to Section 102 of Federal Land Policy Management Act, though, to kind of get a better understanding about what Congress was thinking about when they formed the Bureau of Land Management, or at least built our Organic Act. In one sentence, the mission of BLM is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of public lands for the use and enjoyment of present and future generations. As I mentioned, Congress saw this as containing both multiple use and sustained yield as key components. Multiple use has many definitions. It's not all uses all the time everywhere. BLM has regulations that talk about it real quickly. And I'm going to quote a few things out of our regs here. Management of public lands and their various resource values so that they are utilized in combination that best meet present and future generations of Americans. Consideration being given to the relative values of the resources and not necessarily the combination of uses that will give the greatest economic return or the greatest unit output. Harmonious and coordinated management of various resources without permanent impairment of the productivity of the land and the quality of the environment. A combination of balanced and diverse resource uses that takes into account long-term needs for future generations for renewable and non-renewable resources, including but not limited to, as Bill said, recreation, range, timber, minerals, watershed, wildlife, fish, natural, scenic, cultural, and scientific and historic values. Our regulations also talk about what sustained yield is, and very quickly it's referred to as the achievement and maintenance in perpetuity of a high level of annual or regular periodic output of the various renewable resources on public lands consistent with multiple use. Now, along with multiple use and sustained yield, another important aspect of our mission is conservation. And the conservation ethic for BLM's predecessor agency, General Land Office, was set, as Bill said, by Teddy Roosevelt in the early 1900s. Conservation was focused, was again refocused in the year 2000 by secretarial order when Secretary Babbitt established the National Landscape Conservation System. And in 2009, the Omnibus Public Land Management Act codified that system, in their words, in order to conserve, protect, and restore nationally significant landscapes that have outstanding cultural, ecological, and scientific values for the benefit of current and future generations. Now, while the National Landscape Conservation System really provides focal areas for conservation on public lands, BLM still uses wise conservation principles in the management of all public lands today. quickly the things that are in our regs that talk about conservation. Preserve and protect certain public lands and their natural condition. Provide food and habitat for fish and wildlife and domestic animals, and provide for outdoor recreation and human occupancy and use. Public lands managed in a manner that will protect quality of scientific, scenic, historic, ecological, and environmental, air, atmospheric, water, and archaeological values. Principal or major uses include but are not limited to, as I mentioned, livestock grazing, fish and wildlife development and utilization, mineral exploration and production, rights of ways, which is how our renewable energy program is implemented, outdoor recreation, timber production. So the challenge is to manage both for continued use and the conservation of public lands and resources, and that demands sustainability. I recently read Jared Diamond's book on collapse that he wrote in 2005, and I mentioned that I would have a few remarks to say about that. What Jared Diamond did in this book was talk about, and I urge you to read it, although you may not agree with everything he says, but it's quite interesting. He looked at the environmental challenges that rendered past civilizations unsustainable and that led to their collapse. He lists 12 environmental problems that still face mankind today. And the first 8 are those he believes that historically contributed to the collapse of past societies, deforestation, habitat destruction, soil problems, including erosion and salinization, soil fertility, water management issues, overhunting, overfishing, effects of introduced species on native species, overpopulation and increased per capita impact of people. That's just more people having an added effect of impact on the land. And further, he says there are 4 new problems. And he talks about anthropogenic climate change, buildup of toxins in the environment, energy shortages, which we're talking about today, full human utilization of Earth's photosynthetic capacity. He begins his book in a way that's most relevant to me and to the Bureau of Land Management by talking about his experiences in Montana, where he saw the environmental effects of past mining and grazing practices on the land and resources. He poses a question of whether the area can overcome environmental problems associated with those past activities and become sustainable. As Mr. Diamond explores sustainability, past and present civilization, he looks at 5 factors. And a couple of them are relevant to the discussion today, a couple of them are not. But environmental damage, climate change, hostile neighbors, loss of trading partners, and society's own response to its environmental problems. While the impacts of hostile neighbors and trading partners, and I think I heard it discussed in the first panel, could affect our international energy discussion, we're talking about public lands and natural resources. And so I want to focus on climate change, on the remaining 3 factors, which, and most importantly, the last one, and that is our response to environmental problems. The BLM is responding using a framework that is a landscape-level approach to conservation development as we seek to achieve sustainability. As a result of climate change, altered fire regimes, invasive plant species and animal species, environmental damage from past poor practices, and changes in land use associated with energy and urban development, the American West is experiencing unprecedented environmental change. The rate and scale of change are creating significant challenges to the resource managers, and several critical challenges include managing resources at multiple scales. Traditionally, resource managers have done project by project, permit by permit, without systematically assessing landscape scale effects. To effectively address environmental changes in the West, resource managers have to develop the capacity to evaluate effects on multiple geographic scales. Managing across ownerships and jurisdictions, if you see a map of the West and BLM land, you'll see a checkerboard. Traditionally, resource managers have focused on those activities within their own administrative boundaries. To effectively address environmental change, the West has experienced resource managers have to develop multi-jurisdictional and work across multi-jurisdictional partnerships and work across ownerships. Managing resources across programs. I have about 25 programs in my directorate. And each one, whether it's fish and wildlife, riparian, grazing, any one of those programs is going to compete and have its own cylinder of excellence or stovepipe of regulations and guidance. We've got to work across those programs, across the statutory base, across the budget and job series, and in our training and performance measures. We've got to manage resources. Next point, I've got 2 minutes, and I've got about 7 minutes of presentation. So I will stop professorializing, I guess is what I'm doing. But I really, it's critical that you know that, back to the point, resource managers in the past have not worked at multiple scales. They've not been able to work across ownerships. They've not worked across programs. They've not worked with the kind of uncertainty that we're dealing with today. And they've not had standardized and integrated data that they could bring to the table to help inform their decisions so that they could make good collaborative decisions. So over the past few years, BLM has initiated activities to address these challenges that our resource managers face on the ground. First thing that we're looking at is assessing ecoregional condition. We do that through the rapid ecoregional assessment, working with partners. We're conducting assessments over 400 million acres of public and non-public land in 7 ecoregions across the West to identify potential priority areas for conservation development. The U.S. Forest Service, is in their new planning rule, is using the same type of assessments to inform its planning process. Over time, we anticipate that the landscape conservation cooperatives that were established by the Secretary of Interior 3 years ago will assume a major role in periodically refreshing ecoregional assessments to make sure that our managers and those in partnership with us on the landscape have the best information they can about those sensitive resources and those opportunities out on the landscape for conservation development. Ecoregional direction, we will step down the information that we get in the assessments to the ecoregional level and have it become part of our decision-making process. It'll inform the decision. It won't make the decisions. It'll allow us to inform the discussion and debate in our districts and states and across state lines. Resource sharing for conservation delivery. I think we started building our Healthy Lands Program initiative. Basically, we started building relationships across the landscape to improve the way we manage public lands, to restore lands that were past degraded, as Jared Diamond discussed, and then to inform our development decisions as we go forward. We're working on native plant material programs to ensure that we have the plants and the seeds that we need as the climate or the ecology changes on the land. We're monitoring and adapting and developing adaptive management scenarios for our field offices, districts, and states, and across state lines. In the near term, we are addressing these challenges with the changing of the way we do business on the ground. BLM can't do this in isolation because public lands and resources are your lands and your resources. We need to systematically address the challenges with federal, state, and NGO partners. We need to be more explicit about potential trade-offs associated with our land use decisions. We need to look at establishing resource condition objectives and thresholds in our land use plans and other decision documents to facilitate adaptive management. We need to develop landscape-scale mitigation strategies. We need, including those for stage development, consideration of off-site mitigation associated with renewable energy development. We need more systematically evaluate whether adopted mitigation measures are effective. We need to be able to focus our on-the-ground work where it will achieve the most ecological benefit. And we need to be more effectively tying our monitoring to the effects on the ground and the effectiveness of our decisions. what we're doing in the near term. Our boss, Bob Abbey, brought a concept of SMART from the start, and it is doing the work up front to make better decisions before we commit to the development of a resource. It's a front-loaded decision-making process to ensure that we have all the natural and cultural resource values discussed before making a decision. We're looking at CESs, which energy, and I wrote her name over there so I could use it, I apologize, but she mentioned our solar energy zones and what we're doing for solar energy. We have leasing reform. In Arizona, by the way, in solar energy, they're looking at brownfield sites in a process, in a program called Energy by Design to see if we can put solar energy projects. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Okay. Leasing reform, we're looking at master leasing plans to try to put these, do some upfront decision making in critical areas before we lease. We have an air quality strategy and an air MOU that help us focus together with other agencies on better quality analysis of air impacts and working with industry to solve air problems. We have a multi-state, multi-jurisdictional landscape level sage-grouse strategy to try to move forward with development in areas that are less likely to be critically important to sage-grouse. That is something that has to be done before the listing decision that Fish and Wildlife Service must make in 2015. We're also working with Restore New Mexico and Partnerships for Conservation Development in Utah on landscape-scale restoration projects that inform decisions going forward on how we're going to develop in those areas as well. So we have a lot of things going on, but to be effective in ensuring sustainability for public lands and resources, the BLM must continue to engage in a collaborative landscape scale approach to conservation development of the 21st century. This is not the prerogative of one agency, one industry, or interest group, one geopolitical unit or geography. It is something that we all must work on together. And that future generations depend on. I want to close by repeating the words that Bob Abbey gave me before I came here, and that is the decisions we make about management of public lands and resources affect not only those living today, but those yet to be born. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ed, and I think that was an excellent review of where BLM is going. What I'd like to do is sort of give you a, mix it up a little bit by giving you sort of my perspective. I've been an environmental lawyer and litigator for over 35 years, spent 13 years with the federal government, Department of Justice, representing Interior, among other agencies, in private practice, representing clients in the energy sector and elsewhere. And I think that where I've seen over the years is we've seen a lot of major swings and attitudes towards energy resources and development of federal lands and whether they can sustainably develop. But I've never seen in the public debate today as much polarization. I believe we're in a zero-sum conundrum, either a hands-off energy extraction policy, lock up all federal lands, or full speed ahead. The public debate has gone off the tracks, in my judgment, in a way that goes against long-standing federal policy and goes against irrational and becomes very irrational. We've seen drill, baby, drill as the rallying cry for those people who say, you know, we've got to access our extractive energy resources, oil and gas, so we're going to be outcompeted around the world. We're going to head into a crisis unless we open up the doors to public lands. Drill, baby, drill. Got to move ahead. Then you get the reaction. Every action, you know, the Newtonian theory, every action is an equal and opposite reaction. So then you get the folks say no, and you know, you're going to have tremendous exploitation of these resources. You're going to wipe out years of federal policy. You're going to open the door. Endangered species are going to go to extinction. And so therefore, you have that reaction. And I think, unfortunately, what we come down to is a false choice. In my view, I think energy extraction can be done in a responsible way that sustains federal lands and resources. So while we can favor renewable energy sources, wind and solar and federal lands, in my view, we, in the current climate today and the foreseeable future, we cannot achieve energy independence by redlining federal lands as off limits to oil and gas exploration. You know, we've heard Ed and those of you that have studied these issues and looked at all the myriad of federal statutes and regulations and policies that essentially talk about facilitating compatibility between energy resource development and other legitimate uses of public lands, especially when we talk about the Department of Interior. Ed did a very good job of giving the analysis and discussion of Bureau of Land Management, the various statutes, FLIPA, the Mineral Leasing Act. We've got the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act. We have a variety of federal lands. You know, we talk about BLM, multi-use sustained yield, but you know, we have National Park Service lands. We've got National Wildlife Refuge lands, wilderness lands. So there are a vast array of federal public lands that are managed by the Department of Agriculture and Interior. Now the question is, how do we approach mineral resources, oil and gas resources that are located below these lands? And I think what a rational approach to energy policy would look at the nature of the resource, can you extract it in a reasonable way? The level of protection that is afforded by federal policies, laws, and regulations towards these lands. Obviously, when you're dealing with the Wilderness Act, which is Congress said that we're going to lock up these lands, then there's a real question about whether they should even be accessed at all through federal statutes and regulatory approaches that are laid out for those particular lands. Wildlife refuges, in many ways the same way. When you're dealing with other lands that are not so designated for protection, then there's a question of, is there a more flexible approach? So then you have to analyze, what are the resources below those lands? When you look at the variety of statutes that cross-cut all these federal lands, they have to be applied in a careful and rational way. National Environmental Policy Act. I've worked with NEPA for years. I used to work at CEQ on detail. On the NEPA regs, and that's the granddaddy of federal environmental statutes, the regs that withstood the test of time. But the whole approach is to look at environmental impacts and alternatives in a rational, open way in which we get the public and all the experts involved before a decision is made in a fair and balanced way. Before you move ahead with any kind of decision on whether you're going to access those kinds of resources. When you deal with a statute like the Endangered Species Act, which is a statute that I deal with quite a bit in my practice, and I teach endangered species law at the GW Law School, obviously Congress put protecting and preserving endangered species on a pedestal. You know, you preserve those species, you try to get them off the list, you try to encourage and achieve recovery of those species, and that takes priority over everything else. But does that mean that the ESA can't be compatible with energy development, even given those priorities on restoration of species, achieving biodiversity goals that are laid out in the Federal Endangered Species Act? I would submit that they're not incompatible. Case in point, talking about experiences I was involved in a number of years ago, representing a natural gas company that had a lease to drill in the Padre Island National Seashore. And how many of you are familiar with Padre Island, Texas, have never been down there at all? Well, it's sort of an interesting and unique national park in that when it was created, the state of Texas reserved the ability to access subsurface oil and gas rights through a leasing program. So that was the condition to create the National Seashore. Now, on top of that, of course, you've got all the myriad of federal statutes and regulations that still apply, dealing with the ESA, dealing with the Park Service Act, and et cetera. So in that case, the question is, could you access natural gas resources in the Padre Island National Seashore to help achieve energy independence? We've got a lot of natural gas along the coastal region of Texas and indeed other parts of the country. So we were involved in a situation where a client of ours was applying to Park Service to explore for natural gas. And they knew that there were some resources there. And yet we had a turtle. The Kemp's Ridley turtle, which is a very endangered turtle that propagates along the Padre Island National Seashore. And of course, there's outcry. Well, you can't explore for natural gas. You're going to wipe out the turtle. Its habitat, it's important habitat, it's very endangered, will sort of sacrifice recovery. And yet, we were in a situation where our client actually worked with the Park Service in a very rigid and carefully thought through program of mitigation measures in which there was a real concern about whether oil and gas trucks would actually crush these turtles and impair their recovery. So we worked out a program of actually having convoys going down to identify turtle nests, recover some of these turtles, translocate them as part of that process, and implemented that program very carefully during this plan of operations process that took place. And, you know, it was interesting that the turtle season, a couple of years that occurred, this is going back about 8 or 9 years, had the highest rate of turtle production that they had seen in years because of the stewardship approach taken by our client and yet allowing directional drilling through a whole bunch of mitigation measures. Unfortunately, there was a lawsuit brought by the Sierra Club challenging the ESA process because we had actually worked through informal consultation without doing a formal biological opinion. So we had all this mitigation built in. So we argued that there was a situation that was not likely to adversely affect the habitat of that species that the Park Service agreed to. And so the plan of operations went to informal consultation. We were able to win that case on the same side as the Park Service and Federal Court and the Court of Appeals. But I give you that as an example of where, even when you're looking at the stringent required criteria for the National Park Service lands, even when you're dealing with a statute like the Federal Endangered Species Act that says ESA takes priority over everything else, you can achieve compatibility. And so, and I think that a rational approach to energy development on public lands has got to take that approach. The public debate that says, looks at this as a zero-sum conundrum, I think is a bad approach to a rational energy policy in this country. And I think, you know, we are dealing with extractive industries. We need oil and gas in this country. You know, we have the debate in today's campaign about gas prices being out of control, and everybody says, well, let's go to let's go to clean energy. We've got to go to wind and solar. You know, we've got the climate change debate, which I personally believe is an important debate. I think the naysayers that say climate change is not a man-made issue are out to lunch. I think the evidence is there. So we have to work responsibly to deal with those issues. But I don't think that we can throw out the idea of accessing oil and gas reserves in this country. Doing it responsibly is the way to go, and I think the way we've been doing it, unfortunately, the debate has been skewed. Now, on the technological side, you know, we hear a lot of discuss. How many of you are following the fracking debate and all the whole discussion that's going on fracking? And obviously, it's very controversial. It's a technology. But obviously, you know, we have oil and gas reserves in this country. We have the shale gas drilling technology that's been around a long time. We've got the issue of fracking and the effects of fracking. And yet we've seen the opportunity to access these oil and gas reserves around the country, following what's happening in North Dakota and places like that. So the technology is being developed, and yet we're seeing also a lot of issues regarding dealing with the effects of fracking. So I believe that we've got to look at that issue very carefully. The technology's got to be analyzed very carefully. We've got to develop a regulatory system that addresses the risks. It's always a risk. You know, even when you try to access oil and gas reserves, no guarantee that you're going to be able to do that successfully. You know, no guarantee you're going to have the investments that you need. But we can't say, forget it. You know, we have a key to energy independence in this country. We have to promote clean energy. Don't get me wrong, sun, solar, and wind. But that's got to be in combination with other resources in a responsible way. So I guess I'd sort of wrap up in my hard-hitting kind of approach that I think we need a rational, balanced, and technologically sound energy policy that allows for oil and gas extraction of public lands. I believe it can be done sustainably to preserve our important resources and yet help move us towards energy independence. Thank you.
I think I'll sit here. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. I certainly want to express my appreciation to the folks at Washington College of Law for inviting me this morning. I want to talk a little bit about environmental law, natural resources law, and some of my experiences at the Interior Department, where just the type of conflicts we've been talking about have arisen over the years. When I talk about environmental law, I sort of make a distinction between pollution law and natural resources law. They're both sort of branches of environmental law. And so you have EPA administering primarily the pollution side of it, clean air, clean water, et cetera. And you have then natural resources law, which involves oil and gas, coal, water, endangered species, marine mammal protection, a whole plethora of sort of resource-specific laws that constitute natural resources law. And I focus my career on the natural resources law side. And increasingly, in my experience, I've seen that natural resources law really has become the new energy law. As Larry has pointed out, there are always these conflicts with unlocking any resource, oil and gas, or even I'm going to talk about solar, renewables. Any one of these is going to have some kind of conflict with another important resource that Congress and federal agencies have said need protection. I think in your legal careers, if you pursue in this area, you're going to find that your most value added as an attorney is reconciling with your client and with federal agencies and the environmental groups who may have an interest, other stakeholders, a solution that protects important resources, natural resources, but enables or unlocks the ability to produce the energy. So I'm going to talk about a couple of different examples. One great thing about natural resources law is you often find yourself in the front section of the Washington Post. And this morning when I woke up, this was no exception. On page A7, there is a good article on solar energy development in the California desert and the conflict with the desert tortoise. And I've been in private practice for the last year, and Bright Source Energy is one of Perkins Coie's clients. In the Ivanpah project that was discussed today in the Post is one of our projects. And the article talks about how this area of the California desert, which is, as you heard Michelle in the earlier panel talk about, how that was all that red area you saw in the California desert is prime solar energy land. But it also is populated by the desert tortoise, a federal endangered species. What happened was our client, Bright Source, applied to the Bureau of Land Management for a permit to construct this facility. It's the power tower technology that Michelle from Abengoa talked about. So it's quite a big area of land. And when the application was made, BLM and the Fish and Wildlife Service went out and they started counting all the desert tortoises that may be in this area. Well, this happened to be during 2007, 2008, when there was sort of a drought out there. And during droughts, tortoises go underground. Fish and Wildlife, following the provisions of the Endangered Species Act, this was a project that was determined that may adversely affect an endangered species. So we went through the formal consultation with Fish and Wildlife Service, and they gave a biological opinion, said it would not jeopardize the species. And when you get that, you also get an incidental take permit that allows you to incidentally take tortoises. And in this case, the incidental take would be picking them up from the site and putting them outside of a constructed fence so that the area could be cleared without harming any tortoises. So the permit said you get a permit to move 36 tortoises. So everybody's happy we're starting off. And this project's supposed to take about 18 months to complete, and within 3 months they'd reached 36. So everything shuts down. There's no more permit to take or touch one of these critters. So back to Fish and Wildlife Service for a new biological opinion, which took about 3 months to do. Now, client, I think the number is something like 165 tortoises, so you can see how many of those critters must have burrowed underground in 2007 and 2008. But now they're back operating. And, of course, the inevitable litigation has come up with the one of the primary claims being BLM and Fish and Wildlife couldn't have permitted that thing properly in October 2010 because in January 2011, it was found out that they had guessed wrong or forecasted wrong on the number of tortoises. So we've been defending that litigation. We've been successful so far. It happens to be a doctrine that federal agencies make a decision on the information available to them at the time. And then, of course, the escape hatch or the off-ramp here is the reinitiation of consultation once you reach your limit of the species that you can take. So we properly went back through that process and got a new permit that covers the remaining construction. And we've been successful in defending that litigation so far. So that's an example of how in the renewable area that you have this kind of conflict with an important resource, the endangered species. I want to talk about water law and my experience with the Bureau of Reclamation at Interior and the National Park Service. There is a very important dam that sits just above, about 50 miles above the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River. It's the Glen Canyon Dam. And Glen Canyon Dam generates electricity, and it's an important source of electricity for Southern California. And as a base load, it ramps up in the afternoon. Whenever I always think of everybody opening, at least it happens at my house, the refrigerator opens, you go in to get a beer, and the light comes on, you know, multiply that by, you know, 20 million people, and you've got quite a power load. So what was happening there is that in the afternoon, they'd open up the penstocks at Glen Canyon Dam and run the turbines full speed, throw that money, throw that energy on the grid. It is money. And you were having this daily fluctuation in the river going through the Grand Canyon. Well, that was not the natural hydrograph, let's put it that way. The natural hydrograph is a huge spring flood and then diminishing amounts of water in the river over the year with no real day-to-day variation. It sort of ramps up and ramps down over a period of months. So this everyday pulse was like scouring the river, the beaches alongside that form along the river. And the beaches are very important for lots of reasons. One, that's where you camp if you're running the river. You will end up spending the night on one of these beaches. But it's also very important to have these beaches because plants grow there. They are the source of food for deer, other animals that live in the Grand Canyon. And they also serve as a basis for fish propagation. This is where fish would find protection from the full flow of the stream in order to propagate. So we worked on a project where we did a pulse flow as an experiment. And this is actually where we used NEPA as the NEPA procedure sort of as a protection. The idea of this pulse flow would mimic the spring flow. What happens is there are a lot of tributaries to the Colorado River within the Grand Canyon. And they bring a lot of sediment down to the edge of the canyon, to the edge of the river, excuse me. And you need that pulse flow to knock all that stuff, smash it all up, and send it down the river. And that creates the beaches that are so important that we've talked about. But because of this daily sort of measured flow, all of that debris had been building up but was not getting flushed down the river. And the scouring was continuing. So we did this pulse flow. And it was opposed by the power interests, believe it or not, because we were basically taking energy out of Glen Canyon Dam, throwing it down the river for this great experiment to see if this was going to work. And it was about $100 million of water that was going to get thrown down the river. And we were able to defend that. We said, look, federal agency, we're doing a NEPA study. This is an experiment. We are allowed to go through this process, and we haven't made a final agency action. Nobody knows if this is going to be permanent or not. We're in the process of doing an impact statement. And fortunately, we were not sued on it, but we were able to fend that off. I guess folks agreed with us on that point. Anyway, it turned out to be quite a success, and now that impact statement process is continuing. I've sort of lost track of it in the last year and a half I've been out of government, so I can't tell you exactly where that stands. But I just cite it as a good example of working through a natural resource issue, a power generation from water, and an important resource such as a Grand Canyon National Park. Just a couple of other quick reflections. The Arctic, offshore Arctic, the The Trans-Alaska Pipeline has been up there since 1974, and Prudhoe Bay is basically the area that is serving, is providing oil to that pipeline. And what is happening now is production from Prudhoe Bay is getting to be less and less, and you have this Trans-Alaska Pipeline that was designed to carry 100% of what they thought was going to come out of Prudhoe Bay, and now that's declining. It's 45%, 40%. And in that Arctic environment, maintaining that pipeline is extremely difficult. It needs to be full to basically keep it from freezing and creating other sort of engineering technical problems. So we have this important tool to get that energy out of there. Meanwhile, the likely next source for oil is the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas offshore, the federal OCS. And, of course, what you have there, you have bowhead whales, you have walruses, you have polar bears, you have all of these endangered species. So we are working to try to enable the offshore development to occur up there with full compliance with the Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, in order to allow that offshore resource to be developed and potentially to extend the lifetime of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. One last point, the oil spill in the Gulf. I was there at Interior when that happened. One reflection on that is that I've heard many times environmental groups say, well, we sort of had the Gulf of Mexico as a sacrifice area. We never really challenged federal leasing in the Gulf. And we had to choose, are we going to fight off North Carolina? Are we going to fight off California? Are we going to fight off Alaska? An environmental group said, you know, it's just not worth it to us to fight in the Gulf. Since the oil spill, I will say that the environmental groups have, you know, the light bulb was turned on, and they're realizing that because of the lack of sort of pressure that environmental litigation can give, that the agencies were, and this is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and NOAA and had perhaps not dotted every I and crossed every T out there. And now they're looking, the environmental groups are looking with a microscope at the various permits. So that happens to be good for lawyers because you know, we're involved with clients there, try to make sure that their endangered species mammal permits are all up to snuff. And again, another example where you've got a practicing lawyer is going to find dealing and accommodating, helping your client achieve compliance, I guess is what I want to say, with the endangered species and other protective laws are very important to extracting the value out of the various natural resources. And I'll end right there.
Great. Do I have to sit behind the desk or stand behind the podium?
You do, I think, for the microphone, unfortunately.
Oh, I do?
Yes.
Then I'm going to stand behind the podium, then, as requested by rule. I'm Tyson Slocum, and according to the agenda, I'm the last man standing between all of you and lunch. So I'm going to try to keep these comments as brief as possible, because I do not want to be accused of denying you access to food. How many of you drive a car on a regular basis? Show of hands. What's going on when you fill up your car with gasoline? Anyone want to tell me?
Yeah. Sticker shock.
Oh, my God, the price of gas is so high, right? It's crazy. Now, I don't have a car. I got here on a new bus line that I discovered, the N bus line, the N4, which is awesome, like downtown to AU in like 25 minutes. Unbelievable. I've lived here since 1997. How come I just today discovered that bus line? It's great. But anyway, the point is, gas prices are crazy high, and it's creating significant hardship with working families across the country, okay? And it's creating, as one of our presenters mentioned, mass hysteria among the political chattering class about what to do and who's to blame. And the narrative is ridiculous, right? The narrative that we're hearing, I mean, Mitt Romney said 2 days ago that President Obama is intentionally causing gas prices to go up, right? And he says that with a straight face and there's no laugh track, right? And the narrative is that actions by the Obama administration are intentionally preventing the access that we need to fossil fuel resources that can directly lower gasoline prices for struggling families across the country. And that narrative is a complete and utter fabrication. There's no truth to it whatsoever. None. But yet it persists, because in Washington, D.C. today, facts have become completely irrelevant to the political debate. They no longer matter. In fact, if you try and insist upon throwing facts in there, you're drowned out. I do a lot of cable news shows, and I did a show, I have no idea why, on Fox recently. I go on Fox a lot. And literally, the other guests, we were talking about gas prices, were shouting me down. It was 3-on-1, and I couldn't even make my point. And for those that know me well, I'm not shy about making my point. I have a loud voice. But anyway, in 2011, the United States was the third largest crude oil producing nation in the world. Right? Did you guys know that? Right? Often, the American people, when they're asked, they assume that we, unless you're from the city of Houston, we have the understanding that we don't produce a whole lot of oil and gas in this country. We're the third biggest, behind the Saudis and the Russians. We are the single largest natural gas producer in the world. Right? We're the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. We're the second largest coal producer on the planet. When you put it all together, the United States in 2011 was the largest fossil fuel producing nation in the world. And on federal land, one-third of our oil production comes from federal land, primarily from the Gulf of Mexico. So federal land is currently a significant source of our unbelievably large oil production in this country. In an analysis in 2007 by the Energy Information Administration, which is the statistical branch of the Department of Energy. Now, 2007, this was during the Bush administration. They conducted an analysis. They said, okay, what happens to oil and gasoline prices if we open up every area offshore that's off the Atlantic coast, other areas in the Gulf of Mexico, all around Florida, off the Alaskan Arctic, and off of the coast of the West Coast. We open it all up to new oil production. What's going to happen to prices? What was their conclusion? Insignificant impact. Because for all of the massive daily production that the United States engages in, we are sitting on a relatively tiny puddle of reserves that are underneath in terms of crude oil. And therefore, our ability to significantly ramp up production to influence global supply and demand is severely limited. And that is why the Bush administration concluded that it would have an insignificant impact. Again, these are facts. And I understand that these facts are irrelevant in today's political discourse. But they become very important when we talk about disturbing the current balance we have about how do we treat endangered species, how do we deal with preventing another BP disaster in the Gulf, how do we ensure that we can hydraulically frack natural gas without contaminating water. These are all critical issues. And the first thing that we need to understand is that we need to remove the gun from the head that has been placed there by this hysterical mob saying that we need to open up all these areas and we need to drill and drill and extract our way to protect working families from these high prices. It's all a fabrication. Okay? And we need to remove that level of hysteria and address these issues in a balanced, thoughtful manner, because we have to understand that today's energy production is for today's energy consumption. And we have to understand that there are legacy issues, that there is no such thing as benign or safe fossil fuel extraction. The industry, I think, does a very good job of doing it as safely as they can. I think they do a better job than the Russians do. But there is nobody in the industry that is going to say, we leave no footprint whatsoever when we're pulling oil out of the ground, when we're hydraulically fracturing natural gas, or when we're extracting coal. This is a messy business, and there are enormous environmental legacies that are involved. And we need to understand that all of today's production is for today's consumption. 1956, that was an interesting year. And no, that wasn't the year that Don Draper started at Sterling Cooper, for those of you that watch Mad Men. That was the year that Congress passed something called the Interstate Highway Act. And that act in 1956 is what we all should really be looking at, because that is what radically transformed transportation infrastructure in this country. In 1956, the United States produced 100% of its oil needs. Remember, we're the third biggest oil producer in 2011. Back in 1956, we were just as big. We just didn't use as much. Then we radically transformed our transportation infrastructure because people love driving. Look, I'm one of them. I don't have a car, but when I get to drive a car, it's fun. My dad, when he retired, he was career military, he bought himself a Porsche. That's a fun rocket ship to drive, right? Driving is fun. But there's consequences. There's consequences when you have 150 million vehicles on the road and they're all using the same thing to power that internal combustion engine. And so the United States does not have a supply side problem, right? We're producing more oil today in 2012 than we were since 2001, right? Now, in March 31st, 2010, President Obama made a big speech at an Air Force base in Maryland. How much time do I have?
A few more minutes.
I'm going to talk for less than a few more minutes. And on March 31st, 2010, President Obama announced one of the largest proposed expansions of offshore drilling in a generation. And what happened 2 weeks after that speech? The BP Deepwater Horizon. If you want to look at an incident that disrupted the production of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, it was not necessarily the Obama administration. It was a private foreign corporation that had no plan whatsoever to deal with a catastrophic blowout in a mile deep of water. And in fact, during congressional testimony later that summer, not a single one of the major oil companies, Exxon, Shell, Chevron, Conoco, none of them had a plan. We instituted a moratorium that lasted through October of 2010, and companies seeking obtain new permits in deep water have to go through a whole bunch of new certifications, including third-party verification of those blowout preventers, as well as a number of other tasks. This was a prudent, necessary move. Permitting did slow down, but it did so because the industry could not verify that its procedures were safe enough. And the federal government, after 5 million barrels of oil and 11 American workers who lost their lives that day, we needed to be sure that we were doing it right. Now, I know that on fracking, I'll just briefly touch on this issue. I've been working on energy issues since 2000. I have never seen a grassroots issue that is bigger than concern from property owners and communities over the dangers of hydraulic fracturing to drinking water. Some of it is people who are scared because they're uninformed about the issue, but a lot of it is because the industry does not have a lot of credibility right now, and they've done a poor job reassuring the public that this invasive drilling procedure is safe. And it doesn't help that we've had changes in recent law that have exempted this industry from oversight under clean water laws. The Department of Interior, less than a month ago, has discussed new rules for fracking on federal lands that would require disclosure of chemicals. So basically, you would have to submit 30 days in advance if you want to what chemical cocktail you are going to be injecting. And I was just at an energy conference speaking on a panel in Houston last week. I go to Houston a lot because that's where the energy industry is centered in the United States. There was a lawyer representing major oil companies there, and he said, look, the way that fracking works is you inject this stuff, you see how your frack works, and if it didn't work so good, you try a different chemical concoction, and you see how that works. And this 30-day notice is just, it's too much. It's going to slow down this whole process. It usually would take us hours. Now it's going to take us a month. This is an outrage. And I said, sure. It's an inconvenience. Forgive me for supporting a month inconvenience for the oil industry in favor of telling local communities exactly what chemicals are being injected into the ground in their communities. Again, I think it's imperative that we have a balance in this country. We're not China, right? There's a guy who used to be a vice president of Shell, and I'm going to tell the story and then I'm done, who has a great agent because he's on all the TV shows all the time, and he says, you know, the United States doesn't get it. We're losing the energy race because China understands it. They understand that we need to quickly approve projects. We need to get infrastructure built in the ground. We need to get these fossil fuels into the market. We need to get these renewable energies into the market as quickly as possible. We don't get it. There's too many delays. China gets it. And I'm like, yeah, China gets it. You want to build the largest hydroelectric dam in the world, the Three River Gorges project? 1.2 million people were in the way. What did China do? They're gone. 1.2 million people gone. Forcibly removed from their land very quickly because China gets it, apparently. In the United States, we have something called the Constitution. We have due process. We have a long legacy of private property rights. I like those legacies. I think they're awfully important. I like the fact that citizens have lots and lots of rights, have lots of legal avenues at their disposal to exhaust those due process rights. I don't think China gets it. I think we do. And I think that we can exist in the system we have and supply our energy needs in thoughtful, constructive, balanced ways. Thank you so much.
I'm doing a time check to the bosses of this event. How many? So 12:30, seven more minutes?
Five minutes.
See? Really running the show here. All right. I do have a question if folks are shy, but if you do have questions, the two mics here on the side are open. I'm going to count to 10 real fast, Owen. All right, Emmett, there you go.
So I was going to ask this question already, but you kind of, the last speaker just discussed it. Related to hydraulic fracturing, Mr. Lieberman also mentioned that issue. In the past 6 months, we've now started to hear about earthquakes, and there's a lot of new information coming up here. And I guess when I'm at events like this and people talk about the precautionary principle, a lot of people roll their eyes, including me probably, but is there, when we're talking about the policy that applies to all landowners or all mineral owners, that maybe we the people wouldn't want to impose as much, but as landowners ourselves, the United States citizens, should there be a higher bar, and this goes more generally beyond fracking, but should there be a higher bar for how careful we are with our own property?
I can sort of give my first response, and I must say, Tyson, one of the few times in my life I can actually say I agree with public citizen views, but very much I think Tyson captured certain themes. My personal view, having worked in these issues, and I'm not speaking for any clients who represent, is that we need to have a very nuanced and careful analysis of the risks involved in any energy extraction approach. And I think a legal system is designed to achieve that. And that's where the debate has gotten so skewed and completely off base, because it's either or. Either we're going to unlock these resources, directional drilling is not a problem, and fracking is hysteria, or we're going to lock them up. And I mean, I think that, we're seeing a groundswell on fracking and the effects of fracking. I mean, I think that's a good thing in many ways, but it shouldn't be used as a bar. I think we've got to move towards more careful analysis of what the risks are. I think that property interests are certainly being affected around the country, and I think we're going to see, hopefully, a more technologically and careful analysis of what the risks are. But given that, then I think we need to develop a system to move forward, recognizing such things, the worst case analysis. We heard this with the BPs. And I think we've gotten away from that. We need to look at what are the worst case consequences of moving forward. And I would personally favor taking that careful approach when you're dealing with risky technologies, but we shouldn't go the other way and say it can't be worked out.
I have a perspective on that question. Folks should keep in mind the difference between the Commerce Clause and the Property Clause of the Constitution. When it comes to what's getting pumped into the ground for fracking, I think EPA has been studying this, and they, from a policy standpoint, they would probably like to move in a direction to do some regulation of this, but you have the U.S. Congress sort of standing in the way. EPA primarily, its authorities are based on the Commerce Clause. Interior Department, with the leases, oil and gas leases, and then requiring the lessee to reveal various information, that is a property clause action. It's the U.S. acting as a landowner more than acting as a government. So to answer the question, I think it's just plain and simple. As a landowner, the U.S. ought to know what's going into its lands, I support the fact that BLM is moving in this direction.
Can I quickly respond? Some of the issues with the earthquakes, particularly in Youngstown, Ohio, was actually not related to fracking, but related to fracking wastewater disposal wells. That was a 9,000-foot deep well, and some of the issues that are coming to the surface now are whether or not we need to start requiring some seismic surveys with some of those disposal wells, particularly when they're extremely deep. On the issue of contamination from fracking itself, I think it's actually a very remote issue. The big issue is when some of that fracking fluid comes back out of the well. About 15 to 20% of the millions of gallons that are injected, most of it stays deep down in the formation, but some of it comes back up. How you deal with that and how you dispose of that is going to be very, very critical. But one thing that I've been hearing from many of the folks that have contacted us, where the industry has said, there are no examples of well or water contamination from fracking, in the dozens and possibly hundreds of cases where some households have received water from clean water, bottled water from the industry in response to concerns about well contamination, those households were all required to sign legal non-disclosure agreements, which forbid them from talking to the public or to us or to lawmakers or to investigators after the non-disclosure agreement is signed to talk about whether or not XTO Energy or Chesapeake Energy had a role in contaminating this well. And so my point is that there's a whole lot of data out there that is now removed from the public debate because of some of these non-disclosure agreements, and that might be an issue to examine going forward.
Thank you, Tyson. Gentlemen, I guess the last question of the morning.
Question. I wanted to offer two observations, if I may, one of them to Mr. Slocum in regard to his earlier remark regarding Shell. In light of the case Kiobel against Royal Dutch Shell before the Supreme Court, I'm not so sure that Shell has any reason to hold its head up high, even if 0.1% of what is alleged in the case is true. They ought to reflect on their own past deeds in regard to the former Shell official saying that China gets it. I am with you that I don't think China does. It might appear that it does right now, but very soon we will see that it does not, and then we will have difficulties. The one thing I wanted to offer, and I've listened to a good many of the presentations, is this: the recurrent theme is that the lessees go about speaking to various property owners, whether they be homeowners or whether they be large property owners. And I want to share with you an experience I had 35 years ago. I was working in a previous incarnation as a geologist, and I was the exploration geophysicist for a 267,000-acre lease area in the Commerce Prairie in Idaho. And one of the ways we went about dealing with that particular potential conflict is that we organized all of the property owners in a corporation. And the corporation then became the lessor on behalf of its shareholders and had to deal with the lessee. And all of these things that you talked about basically were set aside in the sense that they had to come to full disclosure, and we would not sign a non-disclosure agreement that would be against public policy. So that might be something useful in the future. And I was thinking about what might have happened had the fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico, and fishing women also, had they been organized in a corporation like that, they may have had collectively a much greater bargaining power than all of these selective settlement agreements that prevent disclosure of material facts in the pursuit of other cases, because it's clear that corporations are fighting a rearguard action. So that's just my little contribution to the discussion going on here. Thank you for your remarks.
Thank you. And I will close this session with two things. One is to just point out, based upon what the gentleman just said, that information frequently is power on these natural resource conflicts. And then secondly, to thank our distinguished panel. Thank you very much.